It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, our guest says for-profit colleges have an important role to play in American higher education, even amid high-profile criticism and fines.
Right now, we're continuing our coverage of the Tony Robinson case. As we've been discussing throughout the afternoon, Dane County District Attorney announced that charges will not be filed against Madison Police Officer Matt Kenny, who fatally shot 19-year-old Tony Robinson back in March, and we'll be taking more of your calls on this coming up.
You can call in now at 800-642-1234 with your reaction, with your thoughts. Let's give a listen to Dane County DA Ishmael Ozan talking about why no charges will be filed.
I conclude that this tragic and unfortunate death was the result of a lawful use of deadly police force, and that no charges should be brought against Officer Kinney in the death of Tony Robinson Jr.
We'll get more updates on how the community is responding to this decision in just a little bit. But first, we're joined by WPR's Shemaine Mills. She was at the Robinson family press conference, which just wrapped up a few minutes ago. Shemaine, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Hi, Veronica.
Well, first, Shemaine, this is a pretty brief conference. Who spoke?
Extremely brief. The family attorney, John Lobey, that's a civil rights firm based in Chicago. They also have offices in Colorado. The grandmother of Tony Robinson also spoke, Sharon Irwin, and his uncle, Turin Carter, also spoke.
Let's talk about them each in turn. What did we hear from the attorney representing the family?
Well, they vehemently disagree with the district attorney's decision. They said they had hoped it would go the other way and that the officer, Matt Kenny, would be judged by a jury of his peers regarding what they perceive as unjust use of force. Of course, that will not happen with the DA's decision. There will not be criminal charges filed.
Any indication from the attorney of whether they're considering civil charges?
No, and they did not take questions afterwards. They each spoke briefly, and then the press conference was over. There were no questions allowed by reporters.
And what did you hear from Tony Robinson's family members, grandmother you mentioned and uncle?
The grandmother was very cheerful. She used the word slander to describe how her grandson was described in the media and in reports, and she made a point of saying she was wearing a sweater because it was the only comfort she was provided. She could no longer hug her grandson.
And Tony Robinson's uncle also spoke. What did he say about their plans moving forward?
Well, Turin says he misses Tony Robinson terribly. And he made a point of saying this decision does not indicate the officer was guilty or innocent, just that, of course, there will not be a trial. And the attorney for the family said, we understand everyone's First Amendment rights, and there's a march that's gathering now. They're going to go to the Capitol. But he urged calm, and he urged people to rally peacefully.
And Shemaine, before we let you go, just setting the scene there, was this just a bunch of reporters hearing this, or were protesters and community members there as well?
Well, we had a number of faith leaders. They sang beforehand and offered a moment of silence after the decision when it was announced by the DA. The crowd is rather small, and I had at least three people tell me the decision was not unexpected. So that may have played into it, and the fact it's rather chilly.
Shemaine, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date. That was WPR reporter Shemaine Mills. She just was at a family press conference from the family of Tony Robinson, reacting to the decision from District Attorney Ishmael Ozan not to prosecute the police officer involved in that shooting.
And now we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to District Attorney Ozan's decision to not file charges against Madison Police Officer Matt Kenny? if you support the decision. Why is that? And if you disagree, what do you take issue with here? Call us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
To our callers now, Jordan starts us off in Milwaukee. Jordan, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
Just in reaction, I, of course, I somewhat agree with not pressing charges just because, you know, within the letters of the law, you know, this officer was doing his job and he was doing what he was trained to do. And I think that's actually kind of the issue at hand, is that the training dictates that these circumstances will happen, you know, over and over again. And the reaction from the public isn't so much that, you know, that this was an innocent man, that he shouldn't have been shot, as so much a reaction to, did he need to be shot? If all of crime was stopped, we'd be shooting everybody all the time. You know, is it necessary that this sort of thing has to happen? And the public is just raising the issue. They're not going to present the solution. Until the problem goes away, we're going to continue to have protests over this type of thing.
So, Jordan, if I hear you right, you're saying the decision not to file criminal charges is right, but you would like to see changes maybe in police training and police procedure?
Yes, and it's not retraining, because they're trained to do exactly the right thing right now. They're doing their jobs correctly. There needs to be an alternative that, you know, says maybe we don't need to be sending in people with guns who will lose control of the firearm, consequently having to shoot the people that they're taking control over.
Jordan,
if there was an unarmed population, or if there's an unarmed group, you know, taking care of initial issues, maybe we would be able to stem these, you know, at the source.
Jordan, thanks for sharing your thoughts. We'll go next to Dave in Milwaukee. Dave, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question, because my understanding is that the officer entered the building with his weapon drawn. Okay, so if he entered the building with his weapon drawn, he walked up the stairs, and that's when he hit him with his gun was drawn and aimed at the suspect, and the suspect hit him. Something doesn't make sense there.
All right. Is there more you want to hear on that topic, Dave, about why that decision was made to enter with a weapon drawn?
Exactly, yeah, because no one spoke about that. If you enter the building with a weapon drawn and then walk up the stairs, and that's when they punched him, I'm going, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Why didn't he shoot him right there? You know, or why would you put yourself in a situation like that in the stairwell? You'd have your weapon drawn and say, climb down the stairs. Let's discuss this, you know. But you don't want to do that on the stairwell.
So, Dave, thanks for calling and sharing your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Getting your reactions to the DA's decision not to file charges against a Madison officer involved in a police-involved shooting that's captured statewide and national attention. Jim in Slinger is with us next. Jim, hi. You're on the air.
Hello. Hey, I completely agree with the decision. I'm sure they looked at this through a microscope, like they have all these past four cases, similar results. They're trying not to make any mistakes here in their investigations, and I'm sure they're very careful. And I believe in the law. I believe in our system still. I think this discussion needs to switch to the culture of the African-American youth. It's kind of obvious at this point that they're not afraid to attack police officers. And if you're going to take their guns away from them in any kind of restraint or anything that can protect other people, it's not just them, then it's going to be an all-out chaos on police officers, and you're just going to be enabling the criminals. You're just going to give them more power to hurt more people. You know, having a force that comes in and just kind of tries to talk to the guy, the guy's going to strangle you if he's on drugs. Then who the heck's going to be a police officer?
Jim, thanks for your call. We'll be taking more of your calls coming up and check in with a reporter following some community response in Madison right now.
We're continuing our coverage of the decision not to indict Madison police officer Matt Kenny in the case of Tony Robinson, who was shot lethally in March.
We just discussed Tony Robinson's family's response and some of the arguments behind the DA's decision. Now we're taking a look at the community response.
There were some members of the community outside of the Dane County Public Safety Building after the decision was announced. Here's what one woman had to say.
All these people that you're looking at, that's a mama. That's a mama. There's a mama. All these mamas know how to even going to imagine how it feels. I'm somebody's baby. That's somebody's baby. That's somebody's baby. Could you imagine losing your baby? Can you imagine how that mother feels?
How this mother feels?
A lot of pain, a lot of emotion on the streets of Madison and beyond today. We're talking right now with Brenna Godar, local government reporter for the Capital Times. Brenna, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, Brenna, can you tell us about the scene where you are right now?
Yeah, so about 100 people are marching down William Street right now. The march just started a couple of minutes ago. They're marching and singing with fists in the air.
And who is marching and singing?
It is a really broad range of community members. There's members of the clergy wearing their robes. There's friends and friends of Tony Robinson, and just a huge swath of community activists.
How big would you say the people, the crowds, if we can call them that, are right now?
I would say it's about 150 people or so. It's hard to tell. It seems to be growing, and it stretches about a half block or a block back.
Now, initially, we had heard that the protest, the big protest day, would happen tomorrow, not today. Would you say that that is changing as we speak, or are there just certain groups marching and not others?
I think it is a difference of who's organizing the marches. So today, this march came largely from the family and friends who are close to Tony Robinson, and tomorrow will be organized primarily by Young, Gifted, and Black. But I do think there is overlap. The Black Lives Matter sign is still here, and I think tomorrow it will still be larger than this, but that definitely doesn't mean there's nothing happening today.
And do you know what the scene is like on Williamson Street, the location where Tony Robinson was shot?
Yes, so they just left that site. That's where this group gathered and shared some words of frustration and sadness about the lack of charges against Officer Kenny. And now they have left that site and are marching.
And is there, as you watch the protests, are you seeing any sort of police, any sort of presence like that?
There's a very large police presence, but so far I haven't seen any altercations of any kind. There's about a dozen officers walking ahead of the group on the sidewalks, and police are blocking off the entirety of the street.
Do you know what the plans are for community response this evening? Are we seeing these marches now and there's more planned?
This march plans to go to the Capitol, and I'm not sure exactly how long it will go, but possibly an hour or more. And then at 8:30, I believe, there is a candlelight vigil happening on campus at a Presbyterian house.
Now, we came in before a discussion with you listening to a very emotional recording of a woman responding to the shooting, talking about Tony Robinson's mother and what it's like to lose a child. Are you seeing that kind of emotion on the street with protesters now?
Yes, definitely. I mean, there is, excuse me, just a moment, I need to figure out crossing a street. Yes, there's a lot of anger and sadness. And just feeling that this decision is unjust.
All right. And any plans that you know of for tomorrow? Do you have an idea about how the day is set to unfold?
Yes. At 9 a.m., Young, Gifted, and Black Coalition is planning a walkout, and that will involve schools, workplaces. I believe there's more than 500 people who are already set to attend on Facebook, and that number is quickly growing. And they will gather again on Williams Street at Hugh Street, in front of the house where Tony Robinson was shot.
Well, Brenna, we'll let you get back to reporting. Thank you so much
All right.
for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Brenna Godar of the Capital Times giving us the latest on the community response to the decision not to indict Officer Matt Kenny in the Tony Robinson case. And we go back to your phone calls in just a bit. This is Central Time. Bob is going to be our first caller. We'll take Bob now from Waukesha. Hello, Bob.
Thank you for taking the call. I just wanted to say I disagree with the decision to not file charges. The reason is we, the people, need to have trust in our police officers. And in order to instill trust, we need to have transparency. In no sort of an incident involving a loss of life would you fail to investigate it, whether it be an over-the-road truck driver or an airline pilot. If somebody has died, there's going to be an investigation. Here, we're refusing to even hold the investigation. And that gives the community a sense that they're trying to hide something or to protect the people over, protect the officer rather than the people themselves. furthermore, after they hold a case like that, they should always look at the lessons learned. In any sort of an incident like this, it's not just about prosecuting the officer. Maybe they didn't do anything wrong, but potentially there's something that could be learned that could be put into a procedure to prevent this from occurring in the future. And that kind of community transparency is what's missing here.
And, Bob, we're told that there will be maybe hundreds of pages of documents released now that this decision has been released as well. Will you be looking for more information from those documents?
I feel that usually those documents are a justification for their lack of filing charges. In this sort of a case, it's really about convincing the community that, you know, they're on your side and that they will hold police officers accountable. And the proper way to do that in an event of a loss of life isn't just to hold a closed case, present only the evidence that's exculpatory, and refuse to even hold a trial. You need to hold a trial just so that everything can come out, both positive and negative, and then potentially learn something from it.
All right. Thank you for your thoughts, Bob. Appreciate that call. We're going to move next to Dennis in Appleton. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I think that the DA has evidence and facts that no one else has. So you either trust that he made a fair decision or you don't. If you don't believe in your elected officials, I think there's a bigger problem. But either way, it's a tragedy, and all police force in all cities need to take a look at their training, their attitudes, and yes, there has to be changes made, maybe not because of this case, but because of a lot of other cases.
Okay, thank you so much for your thoughts, Dennis, at 800-642-1234. Getting your reaction right now on the decision by District Attorney Ishmael Ozan not to indict Officer Matt Kenny in the Tony Robinson case. Here was Ozan from earlier in the day at the press conference.
Now, whether we are policing, teaching, or parenting, when we use violence to control, we do so at a tremendous cost to the person, to our community, and ultimately to our humanity.
District Attorney Ishmael Ozan, as he prepared to announce his decision not to indict police officer Matt Kenny in the shooting death of 19-year-old Tony Robinson. Another call now. Christy joins us in La Crosse. Christy, hi.
Hi. Your last two callers, one said that you should prosecute every case to sort of have the trial be a way for the truth to come out, and then the last caller said you have to trust the DA. I guess I'm kind of in the middle. I don't think you prosecute every case because there's obviously cases where the officer is obviously not at fault. But I do think that the prosecutors have such a close relationship with the police officers that it's hard to trust them. I think that every time there's a situation like this, an independent prosecutor needs to be assigned so that there can be some faith in the system. And at least there's, because right now there's an appearance of injustice. Whether there is or isn't in some or all of the cases, there's an appearance of injustice because the prosecutor and the police work together.
And we have a new law in Wisconsin that aims to do that, to have an outside entity investigate police-involved shootings. Does that satisfy you?
Exactly. It should be like that all over the country.
Okay. Christy, thank you for your call. Going to go next to Nathan in Madison. Nathan, hi.
Hi. Thanks. What I'd like to say is that this is an example and an assumption of our democracy. This prosecutor played judge and jury, and the cop played executioner. So we are denied a trial. I think any murder should automatically go straight to trial and let the people decide. In this case, we weren't even given the chance.
Okay, thank you, Nathan. Appreciate you calling in. And next, we are joined by Saeed, who is in Green Bay. Saeed, hello.
Oh, yes, thank you for taking my call. This is a tragic loss of life in Wisconsin and seems to be an epidemic of it around our country. And when I look at that, there's a common threat that's so obvious to me, and that is each of these victims resisted arrest and did not follow police instructions when they were stopped. I think that we need to educate. We've been talking all about what the police can do and how the police can be different. On the other hand, it's commonsensical as citizens that when you're stopped and the police instructs you in a certain way, that you do not resist arrest, that you do not attack the police, that you follow their instructions. I think when you don't do that, you take your life in your hands. And I think of a society, if we make policing difficult, then we better be prepared for lawlessness. Then we better be prepared for the breakdown of civil society.
Saeed, what about the comments from some citizens that following police instruction makes them feel more endangered?
Those need to be adjudicated. I mean, we need to look into those things in a systematic way. But at the moment that an individual has been stopped, they need to follow police instruction. It is very clear to me. When I get stopped in the evening for a traffic violation or whatnot, I pull to the side, I turn my car off, I turn the lights inside the car, and I put both hands at the steering wheel where the officer is stopping me can see where my hands are. That is my responsibility. And
right.
if I get out and charge the police, if the police instructs me to do something and I don't do it, then I am taking my life in my own hands.
Saeed, thank you for your call. Appreciate that.
Thanks for all of your calls and our coverage of the decision today from DA Ishmael Ozan not to prosecute the officer involved in the police-involved shooting of Tony Robinson in Madison. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. For-profit schools have been in the news a lot in recent weeks, and much of the news has not been good for their owners. Increased federal scrutiny, new regulations, fines, and some of them are closing down, partially or completely.
Last month, Corinthian Colleges announced the closure of its remaining 28 campuses with over 16,000 students. It had already sold off a number of other campuses and had been fined $30 million for misrepresenting data on student job placements. Last week, two more chains announced closures. Education Management Corporation will close 15 campuses, the Career Education Corporation, 14.
Despite the news and criticisms over high student debt loads and bad job outcomes, our next guest says for-profit colleges can and should play a positive role in American higher education.
Judah Bellin is with us now. He researches higher education policy at the Manhattan Institute, and he's the associate editor of the blog Minding the Campus. Judah, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Judah, in a piece earlier this year, you wrote, for-profit schools have received plenty of bad press in the past few years, much of it justifiable. On average, students who attend for-profits have poor graduation rates, high loan default rates, and dismal job prospects. Furthermore, numerous news reports have exposed for-profit colleges' unsavory recruitment practices. Now, Judah, you wrote that, and you're the guy defending these schools. Given all that, what value do you see in for-profit colleges?
That's right. I would say that, again, though the overall story of the for-profit industry, at least it's been portrayed in the media, has been negative, I don't think this should lead us to discount the industry entirely. And as I mentioned in a recent article I wrote for City Journal magazine, the for-profit model is actually very productive in terms of thinking about how to reform higher education. The for-profit colleges, unlike their non-for-profit peers, don't suffer from entrenched bureaucracy, tenured professors, alumni, trustees, and can therefore change their course offerings at a much quicker rate than traditional non-for-profit schools. And they can, in fact, change their course offerings to adapt to what the labor market is demanding. So that leads many schools to sort of eschew the traditional liberal arts courses in favor of very relevant courses that lead students at good for-profit schools, into lucrative and meaningful careers. So I think, you know, they present a very useful alternative to thinking about what higher education could be. And in some cases, they actually do provide a worthwhile education.
So they're nimble, in effect. They can say, hey, here's the programming language, for example, or here's the kind of robot repair that the market needs now, and they can get a course up and running, say, next semester instead of 3 years from now.
That's exactly right. And since many for-profit colleges use actual industry practitioners as their faculty, students can know that what they're learning in the classroom is not merely theoretical, but it's actual information that's relevant to their careers, that's relevant to what the job market is currently demanding.
So that's the model you're saying, but it seems like there have been fines for misrepresenting job outcomes for students, criticism over high debt. is that model what's really happening at for-profit campuses around the country?
So if you look at some of the larger chains, right, the EDMCs, the Corinthians, University of Phoenixes, you see pretty bad outcomes there. You see a lot of the fraudulent practices, the deceptive recruitment techniques that have been written about, and you see again the poor outcomes, poor graduation rates, bad loan debt rates as well. But if you look at some of the smaller for-profit schools, for example, if you look at the schools in New York where I live, you'll see that there are a good number of schools that are actually fulfilling the promise of the for-profit industry. That is to say, they are offering a relevant curriculum. They are graduating students with relatively low student loan default rates, and they are graduating students at graduation rates above the national average. So that is to say that, you know, I think that the for-profits that receive the most media attention certainly are subpar by and large, but I think, again, that neglects, you know, the broader story of the for-profit industry.
Last fall, the U.S. Department of Education announced what they're calling a gainful employment requirement. In a nutshell, as I understand it, this means that vocational programs, that includes for-profit and community or technical colleges, have to meet job placement standards to stay eligible for federal student aid. There have been lawsuits on this. Right. It's due to come into effect in a couple few months if those lawsuits are unsuccessful. What would change in the for-profit world in particular?
Well, the for-profit industry has been preparing for these gainful employment mandates for a long time. As you said, the Department of Education has tried to institute them before, but these mandates were successfully challenged by the for-profit industry's lobbying group. What would change, essentially, is that for-profit colleges would face heightened scrutiny in terms of their outcomes. So if a certain percentage of their students are not repaying their loans at a particular rate, then they would become ineligible. Within a given period of time, they would become ineligible for federal aid. And since most for-profit schools draw from poor students, poorer groups, that would be fatal to their business prospects. Not receiving federal aid would lead to widespread closures.
Do you think for-profit colleges are getting unfairly targeted, too much scrutiny from the Obama administration, and maybe not just the bad schools, as you were describing earlier, but the good schools you were talking about would be hurt by this?
So I think I'm conflicted. On the one hand, I think it's too much scrutiny in that the Obama administration, the Department of Education, has not been giving nearly the same degree of scrutiny to any other sector. You know, the for-profit industry certainly has its bad actors, and it might have the most bad actors, but it's certainly not the only sector that has bad actors. And in fact, a study from the New America Foundation showed that with the new gainful employment measures, I think some 20% of for-profit colleges would become ineligible for Title IV aid, but a non-negligible percentage of community colleges and private colleges would also become ineligible. So that's today. I think it is worthwhile to connect the delivery of student aid dollars to outcomes at particular colleges, but I think that needs to happen across the board. And to the extent that it isn't happening, I think that for-profits are being unfairly targeted.
Talking to Judah Bellin from the Manhattan Institute about for-profit colleges. Judah, you mentioned low-income students a few moments ago. One common criticism of for-profit colleges is they recruit low-income students who can't afford the debt that they rack up. But you've written recently that there's an opportunity for for-profit colleges to serve poor students better than anything else out there. So what's the opportunity there, if done right?
Well, you know, for-profit colleges draw poor students primarily because these students are not looking for a liberal arts education, which is what they'll get at a traditional nonprofit school. They're looking for a school that will offer them a flexible schedule, that will offer them relevant skills. And for-profit colleges, again, when, you know, they're not fraudulent, when they're well-designed, when they're well-regulated, can actually offer poor students, those outcomes. And I've seen this, I've recently written about, poor students who I've met in New York City who really weren't unable to thrive in a non-for-profit environment, either because they didn't have as much direction or because it just didn't fit with their schedule. But the for-profit colleges really gave them the opportunity, it really gave them the flexibility to get relevant skills and to get their degree and to get a good career.
Well, you use the phrase well-regulated. What would well-regulated look like for for-profit schools to get those kind of benefits you're talking about?
Well, I think policymakers need to turn to New York State's example, again, which is the state in which I live. New York State has very strict rules about what sort of for-profit and just what sort of for-profit corporation can operate colleges in the state. So you have to, its owners have to show that they have no history of fraud, that they know how to run a business, they know how to run an educational enterprise, and that has, for the most part, kept out these sort of large predatory institutions that you hear about in the news. So on the one hand, there needs to be tighter regulation. But on the other hand, I think New York State and other states as well, New York State does promote the good work that for-profits are doing and has made efforts to connect students to the well-run schools that exhibit excellent outcomes. So I think you need to have both. You need to have tighter regulation, but you also need to have encouragement from the state of good schools.
We're talking about for-profit colleges with Judah Bellin for the Manhattan Institute. There's been more federal scrutiny of student debt and job outcomes at those schools and some high-profile closures and even a major bankruptcy over the last few weeks.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know gone to one of these for-profit colleges? Was it a good experience and was it helpful on the job market? Do you think that the federal government is right to pay closer attention to these schools? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation about for-profit colleges with Judah Bellin from the Manhattan Institute. In a recent piece linked on the Central Time Facebook page, he says, despite recent criticism, for-profit schools can and should play an important role in American higher education.
You can join the conversation. Do you have an experience at a for-profit school? As a student or maybe a staff member, what's your take? Some critics have called these predatory schools, saying they get students to rack up debt without providing enough benefits on the job market. Do you agree? Should they be regulated more closely? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Larry on the line with us in Madison. Larry, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think about this?
Well, my comment is my wife had been at a for-profit school. And what we found out is that the credits she had earned were not transferable. I mean, they could not transfer to a four-year institution. That the school never told her anything like that before she applied, for the school. I mean, I think that these schools should provide more basic information, not just be about the profit itself, but provide additional information to students that are applying to let them know that your credits are not going to be transferable, that a lot of businesses and jobs are not going to look to these schools as providing you with the skills necessary to perform the tasks that are needed.
Larry, thanks a lot for the call. Judah, do you think that's a common story, and does there need to be more upfront transparency offered, maybe required from these schools?
I think there does need to be more transparency in that the good for-profit schools I've seen, they do sit down with students before they even enroll to sort of talk about, the students' expectations and the realities. At those schools, students are told about whether their credits are transferable, what their job prospects are realistically. So there is obviously more responsibility on the part of the schools, but I would also say that there's more responsibility that's required on the part of the student, who in this case is very much a consumer. And to the extent that the student can do their research and find information about a school's graduation rates, employment prospects, and student loan default rates. Much of that information is available through a federal database online, by the way. They should do that. And unfortunately, you know, many students, and this is true both in the for-profit and the nonprofit sector, many students go to school not knowing anything about, you know, the default rate or the graduation rate. And they're terribly surprised when, you know, they have to end up defaulting on their loans or if they don't graduate. But a lot of this, I think, can be predicted in advance, or one can have a better sense of one's likely outcomes if they just do their research.
Larry, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Cletus in Sturgeon Bay. Cletus, hi.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good. What do you think about this, Cletus?
I think, first of all, I think it's a really, really good idea that we're throwing light on this, because any defaults will become the responsibility of the taxpayers, and it's a huge number. I think that's one part of it. But I think another part of it is that no one's talked about is the fact that college as this golden ticket to prosperity is everyone kind of knows that it's not the only path anymore. And so I think that advanced degrees in education is taking on a whole different kind of flavor these days, and people should be a lot more critical of it. And I can just take any comment off the air. Thanks.
Cletus, thanks for the call. Judah, your reaction to that second point first, that whether we're talking about for-profit, public-private institutions, this isn't the golden ticket anymore. College education may not be what it once was, he's saying.
I have to disagree that, you know, though you will hear horror stories in the news about student debt and graduate unemployment, you know, I don't want to minimize, you know, the truth of those stories, but, you know, basically all research shows that students who go to college, who get a college degree at any level, outperform their non-college degreed peers on a whole host of positive outcomes, whether it's income, whether it's health, whether it's familial stability. It seems that college is a good investment, and I think the question is, you know, not whether, you know, is college worth it, but rather what kind of college is worth it for me. And again, I think the for-profit colleges are worth it for a whole group of Americans. But we don't tend to think of them as such because we hear these awful news stories about the predatory institutions.
Cletus, thanks for that call. Talking to Judah Bellin with the Manhattan Institute about for-profit colleges. We heard on Facebook from Peter, who writes, nonprofit colleges have committed all of the abuses that for-profit colleges have been accused of. For each specific abuse that needs to be regulated, for-profit and nonprofit colleges should be treated the same. So, Judah, do you buy that? Whatever we're doing for for-profit colleges here, apply it to all the other higher education institutions?
I buy that to an extent. So listen, the for-profit colleges, you know, there's a specific section of the Higher Education Act, which is that for-profit colleges or schools that offer quote-unquote preparation for gainful employment, you know, need to prove that they're doing so, or else they won't receive federal aid. So there is an idea that for-profit colleges should receive, you know, special scrutiny. But with that said, I think he's right in saying that we need to apply more scrutiny across the board. And again, while for-profit colleges might be the worst offenders in certain respects, but I will say that, you know, two-year for-profit colleges have higher graduation rates than community colleges. But regardless, even if for-profit colleges are the worst offenders, they're not the only offenders. And the federal government is investing, and the taxpayers are investing quite a bit of money in every sector of higher education. So we should intensify our scrutiny accordingly.
Back to our callers now with Corey in Two Rivers. Corey, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I worked for for-profit college as an instructor for 11 years. And a lot of the things you hear in the news are definitely true. There is a lot of misleading of students when they are being told by representatives what the school can do for them. And the school itself will certainly try and play up their graduation rates and falsify records in order to make them look good.
Corey, thanks for calling and sharing that experience. Judah, I mean, is this a case where it's not we have a few bad apples we need to weed out, but it's mostly bad apples we need to dig through and find the good ones?
I think it, again, it really depends on the state, to be honest. I think you could be pretty confident that one of these larger chain for-profit college companies, you know, like Phoenix, like Corinthian, is not going to guarantee you, or, you know, there's not even, you know, a small chance that you'll really do well there. But it really depends on the individual college. And again, I can't urge this enough. You can find, you know, the federal government's actual records of schools' graduation rates and student loan default rates. And, you know, that might, you know, diverge from what the for-profit college or what the not-for-profit college is telling you, but that information should be very instructive to students when they're trying to choose which colleges to attend.
Judah, as we wrap up, do you think the good players in the for-profit world are going to survive and provide a viable alternative for higher education?
I think so. I think so. I think they will. I do worry that a too heavy hand from the Department of Education will wipe out some struggling but decent institutions. So I do believe that some good ones will always endure. But I will also say that I think it's going to happen that the not-for-profit sector will take some cues from the for-profit sector, and I think we're already seeing that. We're seeing community colleges across the country are. Some of them are moving towards online education, which is, you know, really what for-profit colleges have pioneered. They're also.
We'll have to leave it there. Judah, thanks for joining us. Judah Bellin researches higher education policy at the Manhattan Institute, talking about for-profit colleges with us today. In the world of art, I'll never be able to even think about coming close to being able to afford. There's a new record sale price for a painting.
That's right. The auction house Christie sold a Picasso painting called The Women of Algiers for $179 million last night from an anonymous seller to an anonymous buyer.
Come on. Was one of those you?
Well, where were you last night?
I'm not saying. Okay, no. It wasn't
me.
Yeah,
me neither.
It wasn't you. Well, if you can't afford a $179 million piece of art, here's an invitation to you on the Central Time Facebook page. Share your favorite piece of art that you have up at your house. Maybe something you bought. Maybe something from a kid. Maybe something you painted or created yourself. Share it and maybe a picture. If you can take one over at the Central Time Facebook page. Anything leap to mind in your household? A lot of kid art in ours,
yeah,
of course.
I have a magnificent picture of a dragon that my son made, and I have a friend who draws beautiful freehand mandalas that are incredibly intricate and symmetrical, and those are my favorites.
Amazing. We get a lot of soccer-related art lately these days because that's what the kids are crazy about, the soccer. So share yours, again, your favorite work of art in your household. Maybe if you bought that Picasso, you can tell us about that over at the Central Time Facebook page.